Rick Stevens, financial advisor with FRS Financial Group. Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. For more detailed information regarding any of the topics discussed on today's show, please call 719-500-8700. This is Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial. Here's your host, Rick Stevens.
Welcome in, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial Group. I am your host, Rick Stevens, and this is your show. Remember, if you've got questions you would like to have answered, if you've got a topic you want to hear a little bit more about, please feel free to give us a call at 719-500-8700. You can also shoot me an email. That's rstevens@frsfinancialgroup.com, or simply go to our website, frsfinancialgroup.com. Click on that contact tab up in the top right corner. Send over that question. Send over that topic. We would love to hear from you. Well, folks, this week on Money Matters, I am here in studio, as always, with my co-host, Andrew Rogers. Andrew, it's less than 24 hours until the greatest opening day on the planet.
Yep, as of this recording, still waiting once we hit the air. Probably both of our teams no longer in playoff contention.
That's true. The Cubs are usually pretty good for the first day. Yeah. And then from that, they may be mathematically eliminated. Although, you know, really, this year, if they're 500, it would not surprise me. If they're within five games of 500, it would not surprise me. So they're getting better, technically. Yeah. Granted, it's been almost 7 years now since there was a World Series victory, which is better than 108.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, over the Tigers, it's just the nostalgia tour, so.
Yes.
Watch that get wrung out.
Yep, we'll spend the season watching everybody tell Miggy what a great career he has had.
Yep.
Get all of the cars and the motorcycles and whatever else they're going to give him.
Great way to sell bobbleheads to get some fans in the seats.
Yep. Actually, if you go look at, because I know the Tigers are in Denver this year as part of that farewell tour, those three games are pretty much sold out.
Yeah, well, surprise, surprise. It's also around July 4th and probably a couple fireworks games.
Yeah, there are a couple fireworks games in there, so that could help, I think, a little bit.
And
maybe
with those two teams, at least there'll be some kind of fireworks to enjoy.
Yes, indeed.
Just have to wait to the end of the game.
Yes, indeed. Well, folks, this week on Money Matters, we're actually going to do, well, a little bit of the education side of life again, because, you know, we talk a lot about the concept of markets and the indexes and all those different things. And today we're actually going to do, I'm putting the teacher hat back on today, Andrew, because I live in this world, I sometimes forget that folks don't always totally understand what's going on in that stock and bond world as we know it. So one of those things that I kind of like to do every once in a while, put that teacher hat back on and have some fun, right? Kind of bringing folks up to speed. And Andrew, I've got to ask you this though.
Okay.
Right? Here's that Jeopardy training that we're going to do, because I just like to think of today as a lot of Jeopardy training.
Okay.
On here. Have you ever heard of the Buttonwood Agreement?
I have not.
So the Buttonwood Agreement, this is one of those things, folks, where, you know, if you hear this, you're going to go, what in the world is that? But then all of a sudden, one of these days, you'll go, ooh, I know the answer to that question on Jeopardy, or at least I know the question to that answer on Jeopardy. The Buttonwood Agreement is actually an old, old agreement. It was actually signed way back when, in 1792, about 300 years after Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, but it was actually an agreement written by 24 different stockbrokers and merchants, literally on Wall Street, in New York City, and that actually formed what we think of today as the New York Stock Exchange. It was the Buttonwood Agreement that created the New York Stock Exchange.
Really?
Yes. Yes, and there's some lore that goes along with this, right? They call it the Buttonwood Agreement because it was signed, theoretically, underneath what they call the Buttonwood Tree.
Okay.
Now, you and I know that today as the Sycamore Tree. And actually, some of that folklore even goes all the way back. If we just think back to 2001 and, you know, 9/11, not the greatest memory out there. But part of that lore is that one of the trees that was knocked down at the old church right there by the Wall Street folks was the original sycamore tree, because it was several hundred years old at that point that agreement was signed under. And that's one of those really, you know, sort of crazy folklore type things. But hey, if you ever actually get on, you know, some kind of trivia thing, you know, whether that's, you know, at a local establishment here or you know, you find yourselves on some national show, and they are asking questions about, you know, how and when was the New York Stock Exchange founded? Well, now you know it was the Buttonwood Agreement in 1792.
That is fascinating. But when it comes to forming that stock exchange, obviously we're all very accustomed to it now, and it's really part of our day-to-day. But what led up to needing to sign that agreement and form this kind of exchange?
Well, you know, it's one of those interesting things, and you can almost, right, we see it today oftentimes in the sports world with teams that are attempting to sign or not attempting to sign free agents coming together, and they call that collusion these days. But way back then, you actually had different people in different places selling those ownership shares, those stocks in companies, and charging all sorts of different sales commissions on that. So these folks all came together to basically set up some rules as to create an orderly exchange, right? An orderly market where we're all charging the same amount. We're not overcharging or undercutting. We're basically coming together to say, this is what it's going to cost folks to buy and sell shares with these companies that we represent.
Oh, so kind of uniform. That way you couldn't, you know, say buy one set of shares but turn out to actually not be it, and somebody just trying to make a quick buck on a corner.
Exactly, exactly. And quite frankly, you know, we've talked about this before on the show. It's that start of the regulation side of things. But when you look at the crypto world these days, it's kind of like the pre-Buttonwood Agreement exchanges where we've just got it, we'll sell it here, we'll sell it there. There may or may not be value, but hey, you're willing to pay this for it, we'll take it.
Well, and that's also when they moved all the exchanges off of Canal Street over to Wall Street then, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. And that's, you know, sometimes folks are going, why is it called Wall Street? Actually, because that street was built on a wall at one point in time.
Really?
So it really is, or was at that point, a wall street, which is, you know, just one of those things that we've kind of gotten in our vernacular these days that we just don't necessarily know where it came from.
Yeah, and when it comes to this very early exchange, obviously, you know, the monetary system, economic systems, and the 1700s, 1800s, not at all like what we are used to today. So what did that initial stock exchange look like? Is it started to get up and running as you moved your way into the very early 19th century?
Well, you know, we can kind of see that still today a little bit when we think about things like farmers markets,
okay,
right? Where you've got this big open space, different folks are coming out, setting up their own stands, if you will, and selling whatever items they have produced. We actually have that same sort of concept happening over here way back when, except rather than selling, you know, carrots and corn and tomatoes, they were selling shares of Company A, Company B, and Company C, just doing it in a centralized location now.
So was that something where it was actually like in person, say somebody representing, you know, Company A, let's just say, you know, the Hancock Pen Association, bringing in actual copies of paper shares and actually selling them there in person?
Yes. Yeah, it was actually, you were there doing the actual trading. Here's the money that I have. Now give me that paper that says I own X number of shares. And in fact, a lot of that still happens today. When we're talking about the New York Stock Exchange, you actually still have the buyers and sellers together. They're just now inside of a building with several thousand square feet on the floor. But you're making contact one-to-one with the buyer and the seller, and they've got the hand signals. So if folks have ever watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and you see Ferris and Cameron sitting there on the floor of the Chicago Board of Exchange making these little hand gestures, that's how it still happens today, although we're not necessarily passing the paper as much as it just gets done electronically.
Yeah, and this was based off of some existing, you know, European systems as well. Like, a lot of things really started in those early formative days of U.S. policy, kind of looking at Europe, because that was really the only established markets out there.
Exactly. You know, we weren't necessarily recreating the wheel, but we were taking things that we had already seen and saying, we like these parts, we don't like those parts. Let's take the best parts that we like and put those things together to create something that, well, we think might be better. And ultimately, yes, there are changes that happen over the years, but ultimately what we actually get down to is what's the best, most efficient way to do business here.
Okay. And are there any things that have really, you know, formatively changed? Obviously, looking at these very initial things, are there any, you know, strange things that happened back then that have made their way out of the process and kind of become part of that folklore or part of the, you know, days gone by?
Well, there are a lot of things that we would like to think of that don't happen anymore. But I can tell you that, you know, even within the last few years, right, when you're in this bidding match, if you will, because it's everything is set up auction style, sometimes people get things incorrect in those bidding pieces. It used to happen much more often. Oftentimes there were multiple times a day where there would be actual fist fights to break out in the market. Doesn't happen as much today, but I have heard of a few times where things get a little bit heated still, but okay. You know, we've got some laws about assault these days, so yeah. It doesn't happen nearly so much.
Not probably as many duels coming out of this.
No, not so often anymore. The worst, I guess, thing you could kind of think of are those folks that may or may not, you know, hold a grudge and not actually decide that the company they represent not going to buy from a particular other company being represented on the floor.
Yeah, and when it comes to those companies and things like that represented on the floor, how many companies are there represented on the floor on average?
The short answer is yes.
Okay.
There are a bunch of different companies out there. You know, right now you actually have to buy a seat on the floor to be able to actually trade. It's been a little bit since I looked at the actual dollar amount, but the seat on the floor is not cheap. You know, okay. This is not something that you or I would purchase. This is not something that you or I would purchase if we won the $100 million Powerball kind of a thing. So there are certain things that you have to have as a company to even be allowed to purchase a seat on the floor.
Okay.
So big stuff. You know, you and I aren't going to write that $100 rent check to get any space is basically what we're coming down to.
True.
So some big stuff, big stuff through there. Well, folks, we are coming up on that first break in today's show. When we come back, we are going to talk about some of those indexes that you have heard of, the Dow Jones, the S&P, the NASDAQ. We're going to talk a little bit more in depth about what those are, how they came to be, and quite frankly, why do they even matter? So folks, stick around for today's, maybe we'll call it the trivia update for you to help you win some trivia games right here on Money Matters. We'll be right back.
Does stock market volatility have you wondering which way is up? Do the talking heads and doomsayers have you wondering if this really is the end? If you want straight answers from an advisor who isn't just trying to sell you something, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary appointment today. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC.
Welcome back to Money Matters right here on KRDO News Radio. I'm Andrew Rogers along with Rick Stevens, and we're going over Markets 101, if you will. Getting
yes,
a little
indeed.
Trivia refresher. You know, Rick, before that break, talked a lot about kind of those foundations, how we got at least an exchange. But now we know when we talk about the markets, Wall Street, they're broken up into different indexes or indices. I don't know what the proper English is.
I think
on
the
that.
Answer is yes on that. I think we're okay either way.
Perfect. So let's talk about those specific, you know, different kind of subsections of the market. And let's start with the Dow Jones Industrial and how that kind of came to be.
Yep. So the Dow Jones or the Dow Jones Industrial Average that we think about today, Dow Jones and Company is actually one of the largest business and financial news companies in the world. Now, most folks don't think of Dow Jones as a business or a financial news company. They just hear Dow Jones and they think, okay, this has to do with investing. But it's actually a news company,
okay.
Believe it or not. They're putting out information. And it was actually founded just a couple years ago, back in 1882, right, by some names that may actually sound somewhat familiar here. Charles Dow, obviously, is the Dow mm-hmm. side of that. But there's a fellow by the name of Edward Jones
okay.
that is the Jones side of that. And that is one of the many brokers that still exist today, as well as a gentleman by the name of Charles Bergstresser. And he's the one who always gets left out because it's Dow Jones. But Bergstresser's not part of that name, which is I think, a little sad.
Well, it's sad, but, I mean, you know, maybe he had one of those old-timey disagreements with the marketing folks.
Yeah, could have very well been, and they had to settle it with a duel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of his loss was they pulled the name out. I don't
yeah.
know. So, anyway, Dow Jones, they actually started what's the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the DJIA. And they've actually got all kinds of other indexes as well. But from that financial world, we know of the Dow Jones, and it actually tracks publicly owned companies. It is one of the most watched stock indexes in the world. And initially, there were only 12 companies, and it was mostly in the industrial sector, hence the Dow Jones Industrial
yeah.
Average. So, but eventually, what it actually tracks right now is 30 different firms, typically spread out over a number of different sectors. But when the Dow Jones Industrial Average began, and this will tell you how long ago it was, and actually the difference between the economy back then versus our economy now, they looked at 12 companies in the railroad, cotton, gas, sugar, tobacco, and oil industries.
Okay.
And from there, basically the reason they started looking at that is from that industrial side, right, as an industrial nation, part of the Industrial Revolution, the industrial side of our economy was typically looked at as being synonymous with how the overall economy worked. And that's actually one of the reasons folks look at that today, look at markets today, and think, well, this must be how the economy is going, because it used to actually be that way.
Yeah, but, you know, the markets are not the actual economy, just kind of that canary in the coal mine. And
yep.
when we're talking about things, you know, you hear it a lot, and I always, you know, say it on the radio, looking at, you know, wire copy, different business feeds coming in. They say, you know, the Dow Jones is up, NASDAQ is down. These aren't separate exchanges. It's just more or less kind of tracking X group of stocks, right?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Now, the NASDAQ is an exchange in and of itself, and we'll kind of talk about that a little bit. But they are tracking really two different sort of things. So the Dow Jones is tracking companies that are typically traded on the New York Stock Exchange, although mm-hmm. there are a couple of NASDAQ companies that are part of the Dow 30 right now. One of those that we are very familiar with is Microsoft. Mm-hmm. That's traded on the NASDAQ, but it's still part of the Dow 30. And really, when you look at the Dow 30, to look at that to say, okay, what companies are they tracking in there to kind of give a little bit of a pulse of the economy, even though it is sort of forward-looking in there. Some of these names might surprise folks.
Okay.
Right? So you've got 3M, right? One of the manufacturing companies that is still part of the Dow Jones Industrial.
Yeah, so
average.
Industrial.
We have American Express.
Okay.
We have Amgen, which is an energy company. We have Apple, Boeing, Caterpillar, Chevron, Cisco Systems, which is another technology piece in there. Coca-Cola is part of the Dow 30 because, okay, you know, we want to see how people are taking care of their soft drink needs. Disney, so we've got the entertainment side.
Yeah.
Dow Chemical is in there. So again, that industrial manufacturing piece.
Not related to the actual Dow Jones, though, right?
Correct.
Two separate
Correct.
Dows.
Yep, two separate Dows. Goldman Sachs is in there. So again, part of the financial sector. Okay. Honeywell. We talk about, you know, a lot of folks may have an actual, like a Honeywell thermostat
yeah.
in their house. IBM, Intel. So again, we're getting more of that technology. Johnson & Johnson, mm-hmm. folks who make all kinds of our consumer products is in there. JP Morgan Chase, McDonald's, the world's largest real estate company. Because yeah. that's what I always tell folks. McDonald's is the real estate
Yeah.
Just the biggest real estate company, because you want to know where the busiest intersections in a city are, go find McDonald's because they're on one of those corners. Merck is in there, so we've got pharmaceuticals. Again, Microsoft, we've got Nike, Procter & Gamble. Salesforce is in there. That's,
really?
Again, a technology company.
And fairly new as well.
Yes, yes. Travelers, United Health, so we get the health service side of life. Visa, Walgreens, and Walmart.
So you got everything else you need right there.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the really interesting things is when we look at the Dow, we look at that as an index, we see that since 1884, right? Because one of those things we measure is the up and the down and the up and the down and how has this done? Well, on average, since 1884, so we're talking almost 140 years here, the Dow averages a little over 7% growth per year.
Yeah, and looking at those 30 companies, it is kind of a good cross-section and good kind of indicator of the different sectors across the economy. So it is a good, you know, at least representation as far as, you know, how things are going from the consumer, industrial, financial sides.
Exactly, exactly. And it's going to differ from the NASDAQ, right? Because the NASDAQ is actually an online global marketplace.
Okay.
So where the New York Stock Exchange is in an actual building and you can see the people actually meeting together on the floor doing the buys and sells with one another, the NASDAQ, purely electronic, right? In fact, it was the world's first electronic exchange. And NASDAQ as a group operates 29 different markets.
Okay.
So it's not just a single market. There are 29 different markets. They have a clearinghouse, and what a clearinghouse is basically where you get the buy and the sell together. You look at them side by side to say, yep, that should clear, right? Because you bought 10 at 10. This one says they sold 10 at 10. That means we have a good transaction that has gone on. And they also have 5 different securities depositories, both in the U.S. and in Europe. So again, we are global. And most of the world's technology companies are traded on the NASDAQ, which means that when we look at the index that we see with the NASDAQ, and sometimes it's called the NASDAQ 100 or the NASDAQ composite, what we're seeing is a representation more or less of what's going on in our technology sector of the world. Right now, there are about 3,300 different companies listed on the NASDAQ, and This is just an average trading day. An average trading day on the NASDAQ sees about 1.8 billion, with a B, 1.8 billion transactions.
Wow.
We're not going to get that in the face-to-face markets that you see in Chicago and San Francisco and New York. You're not going to get that many transactions face-to-face in any given day. There aren't enough people there to make it happen like that.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. Now the NASDAQ, we think, oh, technology, it must be fairly new. NASDAQ actually started in 1985. So we actually started that electronic marketplace almost 40 years ago now.
Well, still newer than 1884.
Right. Still 100 years newer, but a lot of folks might be thinking this has got to be something from the 90s when the internet was getting out there and going. But it's actually from the mid-80s. And even since then, since the mid-80s, we've seen just under a 17% annual average return from the NASDAQ, which means in the last 40 years, technology grows a lot bigger than the economy as a whole.
Okay. Yeah, kind of outpacing it. And obviously, the margins are higher in that as well.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, one of the big things in that technology world that we see, and it's also some volatility that we've got with that, because typically in any given year, whether you're looking at the Dow Jones or the NASDAQ, and we'll talk about the S&P here a little bit later on as well, the widest swings, the biggest volatility that you will typically see amongst those three major indexes or indices, again, depending on which English word we want to get in trouble for using, your biggest swings are typically in the NASDAQ because it is so technology heavy. And if you'll remember back, I know you are old enough to remember the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. You weren't in your single digits at that point in time.
Ageism, okay. we'll allow it.
I was definitely in the doubles by several years at that point. So I think I'm okay. And looking at that, so 2000, 2001, 2002, we saw in the markets what we would call these days the dot-com boom and bust.
Yeah.
Most of that happened in the NASDAQ because the New York Stock Exchange has very high limits as to what it takes to be able to actually be allowed to be traded on the New York Stock Exchange. The NASDAQ basically says, hey, if you're a tech company and you're brand new and you want to issue stock, come on, list it with us.
Okay.
So you can have those very small, very volatile companies listed through the NASDAQ, and that's why, or one of the reasons why, we're going to see those wider swings happen on there.
So when we see a lot of the big news as far as, you know, X company is finally going public, having their big IPO, does that mean, you know, that they've reached that certain level to be able to sell on the Dow and make it that big deal? Because it sounds like an IPO on the NASDAQ, it's kind of like a 2007 mortgage. You just have to get a mirror and fog it up.
Yeah. You know, interestingly enough, and this is one of those fun stories, I guess, if you will, you look at a company like Microsoft.
Okay.
Microsoft is listed with the NASDAQ. That's where their stock is traded. They went public back in the late 70s, and because they were very small, their IPO had to be on the actual NASDAQ. However, they were invited years later after getting to be a large enough size to move over to the New York Stock Exchange. And Microsoft basically said no, right? NASDAQ took care of us at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to stay here. So part of that, sometimes the IPO is with New York. Sometimes the IPO is with the NASDAQ. It just depends on how large that company is when it first issues those shares of stock to the public.
Okay.
So you could have IPOs anywhere, but it's all about oftentimes the prestige of having your IPO through the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah, you get the picture. You get to go ring the bell. You get all the pomp and circumstance.
Exactly, because when there's no physical exchange to go do that at, it's not like you're going to Photoshop yourself a picture of, hey, here was us with the listing and it's the computer screen.
Yeah, a picture of you just hitting send on a computer screen. Not as impressive.
No, not quite. Well, folks, we are up against that second break in today's show. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about markets, indexes. What are they? What do they mean? Stick around. We will be right back.
Money affects each of us in different ways. Sometimes it's a source of stress and fear. Sometimes it's a source of comfort and security. Whatever your perspective, it's always good to get a second set of eyes on your finances to help serve as a guide. If you are looking for that guidance, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary appointment. And remember to tune into Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Folks, thanks for sticking with us through that break. Rick Stevens, Money Matters here on KRDO News Radio in studio with Andrew Rogers. And we are, Andrew, we're going through that really the first day of Finance 101 and talking about markets and indexes and what they are.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about two of the big three you always hear about. You see, you know, on the bottom of a screen or ticker or things like that. But the third, and this is something I know you've touched on a lot, Dave Ramsey talks about a lot when he comes to, you know, some of the basic investing he talks with, would be the S&P 500. So where does the S&P fit in between the Dow and the NASDAQ?
So the short answer to that is yes, it does fit in. The nice part with that is the S&P 500, and by the way, S&P stands for Standard and Poor's. Now, how do you get Standard and how do you get Poor's? Well, I can tell you how you get Poor's is by making bad investment decisions, but yeah. You know, that's a totally different sidebar here. But these are actually a couple of different, basically, publishing companies. Henry Poor actually created Poor's Publishing back in 1860, and that was all about publishing an investor's guide to the railroad industry, because that is the big major industry going on in the U.S. there in the 1860s. And in 1923, Standard Statistics Company started basically rating mortgage bonds as to how good these bonds are. And oftentimes we actually still see the S&P rating on a bond today, AAA, AA, single A, BBB, double B, or other, or even an unrated in there. But they developed their stock market index. They had the stocks of 223 companies back in 1923, started creating their own index. By 1926, it actually shrunk from 223 companies to 90, but they went from checking that index weekly to daily. So instead of 223 each week or 233 each week, they changed it to 90 each day. And in 1941, they merged.
Okay.
Poor's Publishing merged with Standard Statistics, and they created Standard and Poor's.
Okay.
By March of 1957, that index, as we know it today, the S&P 500 or the Standard and Poor's 500, was actually put together. They had actually kept growing and growing and growing until now they're looking at 500 different companies across all sorts of different sectors. That starts in 1957, March 4th of 1957, if you want the exact date. And at that point, they then took it and renamed it the S&P 500 Stock Composite Index. Today, we shorten that to the S&P 500.
Okay.
And basically looking at those 500 companies across all the different sectors, and they're weighted a little bit differently. It's actually a proprietary formula that Standard & Poor's does not give out. That's the big thing. They don't give out that formula. They'll tell you what companies they're looking at, and then folks can kind of do that reverse math and basically figure out what percentage is with each. But the index itself, since 1957, so again, we're going on 70 years with that. In the last 70 years, that has looked at different companies, and companies come in and go out of the S&P 500 all the time, has returned about 11.88% on average. So when Dave Ramsey talks about the market and getting 12%, he's talking about the S&P 500 because the historical average, 11.88%.
All right. And, you know, we've kind of talked now about, you know, what they are, what the different indexes are, kind of how that plays with the stock exchange. But what do they tell us? I mean, what's the importance of tracking this? And again, I'll use, you know, my day-to-day example. I can pull up, you know, wire copy, things like that, and the morning show, especially on days where TJ says, hey, you've got about a minute, 2 minutes to fill. and it reads it off. Someone's, you know, kind of putting that all together, compositing it. But why is it important to track, and why is it a big deal to say, oh, the Dow's up, NASDAQ's down, S&P flat, whatever you may say?
So it's a great question. It's a great question. And there are actually a lot of different things that as we look at the index, whether that's in my world of looking at the different things on a very consistent basis, or even as that individual investor when we're out there and we're hearing the different things on the news shows, we got to figure out what does it mean, right? Why is this important? Well, there are three very different looks at the state of business in the U.S., right? The DJIA, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it tells us about those 30 companies that cut a really wide swath across that U.S. business landscape. So we're going to get a pretty good overall feel, sort of an in-general look. Remember, our NASDAQ is teaching us about technology. What's going on in the tech world? How are these technology companies doing? And again, not just tech companies that are traded on the NASDAQ, but mostly tech companies there. But I like the S&P 500 because I think that gives me the best barometer. A, it's not just 30 companies and it's not just one or two in a particular sector, but it's several because it's 500 and it goes across all sorts of sectors. And it really covers even different sizes of companies. Okay. So they're not just these large, able to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange companies. They're mid-size, they're small-size, they're even what we would sometimes call a micro-cap company, a very small startup-type firm. I like the S&P because I think it really gives us the best overall look at what's going on in the business world.
Yeah, and again, these are just kind of like a thermometer, maybe kind of a barometer as far as how things are going. It's not like saying, oh, the Dow's up, that means the economy's good, the economy's stable, though.
Right, exactly. And that's one of those things I think oftentimes we hear on those cable news programs. They like to, sell the extreme. It's, you know, the world is awesome. It's great because the Dow was up 1.5% today. Or, oh my goodness, it's crumbling because the NASDAQ was down 2% today.
Yeah.
It's not actually a today looking set of things. Typically speaking, your indexes are much more forward looking. The markets are typically forward looking. And, you know, whether one is doing great and one is not so great, they don't always work in lockstep with one another. In fact, as we are sitting here today, right now, if you were to look at 10:54 a.m. on Wednesday, the Dow is up just a little under 0.75%, 0.73. The S&P 500 right now is up 1.06, and the NASDAQ is up 1.32. Now, that's all of them up right now today, but all of them up different amounts. But there have been days where you look at it and one is up, one is down, and one is flat.
Okay.
So ultimately, we've got to get to the what are those things showing us. And we also don't want to put too much into just one single index either, because they are showing us all different things.
And you don't want to put too much stock into as well saying, oh, look, the markets are up, everything is hunky-dory.
Exactly, because oftentimes we're looking in the markets 6, 9, maybe even 12 months down the road, kind of saying, well, this is what we see going on in the economy today. This is how we think the value in that company is going to change in the next 6 mm-hmm. months. So, hey, we think it's going to be doing well 6 months from now. Let's start buying that stock today. Or we think that, you know, maybe a year from now there's going to be some trouble, so we're going to start selling our shares in those companies today.
Okay.
So a lot of different things out there. You've also got some other indexes as well. The Russell 1000 is an index that will actually kind of give you a decent look at some things going on. They're actually Russell as an investment company has all kinds of different indexes. The Russell 1000 actually looks at the largest 1000 companies.
Okay.
But they also have an index that looks at the smallest 1000 publicly traded companies as well. That's called the Russell Microcap. So you can see how are big companies doing, how are small companies doing. MCSI is another company that has a variety of indexes, but rather than looking at just what's going on with the U.S. businesses, they actually look globally, and they actually go from not just stocks, but they look at things like the fixed income, the bond world. So there are MCSI bond indexes that you can look at to go, well, what's going on maybe in the bond side of things in Germany or Europe as a whole or Asia? So somewhere out there, if there's a segment of the economy that you want to look at, that you want to see how things are going, there's probably an index for that somewhere.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned, you know, being able to look and see how some of the, you know, foreign markets are doing, how some things are doing, you know, overseas. How do the global markets really interact with, say, our U.S. domestic markets and kind of that more global concept that we have now?
You know, I wish I could tell you that there was a perfect correlation between what goes on in the U.S. markets and what goes on in foreign markets.
Okay.
But that's the beauty of all of this, is there's really no correlation, which is why we want to look at all these different pieces out there. It's also why when, you know, you're talking about whether it's something that Dave Ramsey has talked about with the growth, aggressive growth, conservative growth, and international, you know, getting that mix, or if I'm sitting with folks and working on their asset allocation, we've got a mix. Because just because U.S. markets are up, that doesn't mean international stocks are doing well. And the opposite of that is true as well. Just because international stocks might be doing well, it doesn't mean the U.S. stocks are doing well. And even though the U.S., yes, we are a global leader in that economy and the business world, it doesn't mean that we drive what happens in those international companies either.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, as you mentioned too, it doesn't really have a correlation, so you can't look and see, oh, you know, the German oil markets are going down 6 months later, that could impact us.
Right, right. There isn't that direct correlation through there. And they're not, again, they're not necessarily that leading indicator internationally what's going to happen here, because again, we have to deal, when we're talking on the international world, we've got to deal with all sorts of different things going on. You know, the things going on in Russia and the Ukraine, yes, that is going to affect what's going on in Germany, in France, in the UK, and there's going to be some effect, but that's not necessarily it happened in Germany, so it's going to happen 6 months from now in the U.S. Sometimes those are very close in events. Sometimes there's absolutely no adjustment whatsoever going on from one side of the world to the other, even though we deal oftentimes in that global economy.
Yeah, it's very fascinating to see how this all kind of plays together. And I mean, I know we're coming up on the end of the break, so when it comes to these different indices between, you know, the Dow, NASDAQ, S&P, all the different Russells that you listed out, you know, what's the big takeaway as far as, you know, what we should be looking at and really keeping, you know, our mind focused on?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway is, if you only want to look at one thing, only one of those indexes to kind of give you a state of how the U.S. economy is going to be headed, I like the S&P 500 on that. And again, it's not how the economy is, it's how it's headed. Mm-hmm. But again, if there's a particular sector you want to look at, there are all kinds of places to find that information.
Yeah.
So, well, folks, we are up against that final break in today's show. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about those foundations of investing. We're also going to take a look a little bit at, you know, kind of what the markets have told us over the last few years. So stick around. We will be right back.
Are you worried about what's been going on in the markets and how it has affected your portfolio? Maybe you need a financial checkup. If you have questions about the health of your financial future, call FRS Financial Group at 719-500-8700 to schedule your complimentary checkup. And remember to tune into Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial Group, here on KRDO, Saturday mornings at 9 and Sunday at noon. Products and services offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC.
Hey, thanks for sticking with us through that break, everybody. Rick Stevens here, Money Matters, in studio with Andrew Rogers. And Andrew, I've got a question for you.
All right.
Do you want to know how to make money as an investor?
Yes.
Okay, this is what I taught students, high school and college, for years.
Okay.
And I can almost say decades, because I think from my first day of teaching to the last day of teaching, we were closing in on 20 years.
Okay.
There is one simple way to make money as an investor.
And you're going
to
give it away for free?
I'm giving it away for free right here.
All right, let me grab a pen.
Okay. It's called buy low, sell high.
Okay. Now, is low listed on one of those indices? Is that, you know, the ticker for something? You know, what do I put into, you know, some app to go ahead and just go buy low?
Yeah, well, the short version of it is we never know where the bottom is.
Okay.
But we also never know where the top is. But we think about it like this: when we're putting money into an investment, if we have sold it for a higher price than we bought it at,
okay,
we have made money.
All right.
Now that sounds easy, right? But a lot of folks, they don't make it that easy, because if we stuck with that one principle, everybody could make money. It just depends on how much time it takes to make that money.
Yeah, and the impatience and the emotional, you know, roller coaster with it.
Yep, exactly, exactly. And that's really one of the biggest things that we have to fight against, is making those emotional decisions where logic would dictate something totally different, right? And that's, you know, Dave Ramsey talks about the only people getting hurt on the roller coaster are the ones that jump off. Yes, your portfolio may have been down last year. In fact, if it wasn't down, you were either insanely lucky or you weren't invested in anything, because cash did well last year. However, that doesn't mean that you actually lost money. That means it's on paper. And yes, it went down in value, but if you didn't sell, you didn't lose money yet.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that a lot of people kind of get fixated on, is looking at, you know, whatever your account statement is and the number on there, but realizing that that's not actual money, that that's theoretical money if you were to do something right now.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the big thing in there, is oftentimes we fixate way too much on what does my account value say, and we don't stop to think, well, where did I start? How long has this been going on, and how much longer until I need those dollars?
Yeah. I mean, if only there was like a website or like a social network with a bunch of guys watching this that could tell you when things are going to really, you know, shoot off to the moon, and, you know, where the next hidden gem really is.
Yeah, the Redditors are not exactly your best option for hearing those things either.
I don't know. I hear Blockbuster's making a comeback. Maybe time to jump in. Real financial advice.
You know, and here's the crazy thing. You know, we'll take a short left-hand turn here with that. But Netflix, at one point in time, offered to sell their business to Blockbuster, who said, psh, people aren't going to be getting things through the mail, and nobody's going to watch movies online.
Yeah.
They're all going to come to our stores and rent them.
Well, how'd that work out for them?
Yeah, well, there's still a Blockbuster left. There's still a Blockbuster. I think I still have actually my Blockbuster card somewhere.
Okay.
Because I can remember when we moved to Colorado, there was still at least one Blockbuster up in Monument that I could go rent movies at. That doesn't exist so much anymore. You know, so one of those foundations, right? Buying low, selling high. The other piece, and I always love this, is folks are like, well, I'm going to beat the market. I'm going to beat whatever the market, or in particular, they're talking about the index. I'm going to beat what this is. I'm going to make the best decisions. I'm going to get the best time at doing this. It's going to be, I've got this thing that I purchased on a subscription at $30 a month that's going to tell me how to beat the market.
Yeah.
Except there have been some studies done, and the quote-unquote best money managers, people who are managing hundreds of millions and into the billions of dollars, they make the right decision a majority of the time. So meaning 50% plus one.
Yeah.
about 18% of the time.
Okay.
So the best out there are making the perfect choice less than 1 out of 5 times. So the question then, how do I make money, especially if I'm talking about, you know, I'm working with a money manager and we're using their mutual funds. How do I make money? Well, actually, 82% of those money managers still had positive payoff or positive growth in the funds they were managing.
Okay.
And the reason that happens is because when they made a good pick, they made a really good pick, and it outperformed the bad pick, with all things being equal. The other part of that is they look at it, they see, oh, that was a bad choice, and they fix it almost immediately. They don't sit on the bad choice and hope that it comes back, because I don't know if you've ever heard this phrase or not, but hope is not a strategy.
Yeah, no, and it's the hope that'll kill you.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. As a Cub fan, I know that from years of experience.
Yeah, but now let me ask this, because I know you're going to say that it's, you know, that long game. Again, that old Ramsey adage that the only people who get hurt on the roller coasters are the ones who jump off. But statistically looking at it, when you're talking about making these investments or trying to get some kind of profit on there, how long do you really need to kind of expect to be in that game before you actually start to see that market, you know, marked profit and being able to really see that growth?
Okay, you ready?
Okay.
I'm going to channel my inner Evan and tell you that it depends.
Okay.
Part of it really is making not the perfect choice, because if we've made a bad choice, we just need to right that wrong decision. Now, the question is, how quickly do we know it's a wrong decision? Sometimes it can be within a month. Sometimes it's within 6 months. Sometimes it can be a year or more in looking at the specific choices, right? If we're buying individual stocks, it can be, you know, 3, 6, 12 months to figure out, okay, that was really a bad choice. Typically, though, right, the whole jumping off the roller coaster thing, conceptually, that's I'm going to sell it and just leave it as cash.
Okay.
That's jumping off the roller coaster. What we can actually do, though, is maybe we've made a bad investment, but maybe we've made a good investment decision at a bad time, right? For folks who bought in, say, January of 2021, by March, when the market was down, the S&P 500 was down almost 30%, they're thinking, oh my goodness, I've made a bad decision. No, you made a good decision, especially if you have bought something that is a good long-term option. You just got a bad time with it. However, if you still hold that today, even with 2022 as a whole being down, you're probably still up in that investment, because not only did we see the fall, but we saw the rebound happen in a V shape, which it always does in a pandemic. Don't let anybody tell you it'll be a W, it'll be a U. No, it's always a V. This time isn't different, because historically we've seen it happen. So if it went down, but it was a good stock in a good company, it was a good growth stock mutual fund, it's coming back. We just have to be patient.
Okay.
But we do have to know when it's time to, for lack of a better term, cut bait.
Yeah.
Right? And saying, yes, I made a bad decision, but I'm going to get out of that and into a good decision. And that's one of the hardest things folks have to do, is to say, you know what, I made a bad choice. I'm going to sell low because I know I'm not supposed to do that, but I'm going to buy this other one. But guess what? I'm now buying low in the one I just from the one I just sold out of. I'm still keeping myself invested. I'm just switching where that investment is. I'm not exactly jumping off the roller coaster. I'm just kind of switching seats on that roller coaster.
Okay.
So that's the big thing. And the other part that folks always ask, what's the next big this? What's the next big that? There is no next big. Okay, and that's the part that oftentimes we've got to get through our heads, is there's no next big, there's no get rich quick, there's no next fill in the blank, right? There's no next Microsoft, there's no next Amazon, there's no next Walmart. It doesn't matter. There is no the next. That company that looks like it could be set to grow and expand rapidly, the scenario it faces in the economics of the world it's in right now is going to be totally different than what Microsoft faced in the 70s and 80s, than what Walton and Walmart faced in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. It's totally different.
Okay.
So there's no the next. So any of those folks you hear saying, hey, I've got a great tip on the next, fill in the blank. These guys are getting ready to explode. You want to find out how much they're charging for that advice, because it's probably a lot, and it's probably not tied to what you're actually going to make. It's tied to, it's just going to cost me regardless of whether it goes up or down.
Yeah, and you know, looking at that, you know, when we're talking about this long-term view and things like that, there's actually some pretty good data that shows, even though we know we've come through a couple of down years, a couple of rough patches, that long-term mindset still, at the end of the day, wins out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, there's nothing better to look at, really, than the last few years.
Okay.
If we look at, in particular, in the S&P 500, yes, it's a roller coaster, right? But that roller coaster ride, if you are tuning out all the noise, right? You're tuning out all the whistles and buzzers and sirens and just looking purely at the data will tell you that, yes, long-term, it wins. In fact, if you look at, just look at 2021 as an example,
okay,
right? For the year in 2021, markets did really, really well. But if we start to break those down by quarters, 2021, our first quarter, so January through March, saw a plus of 5.5%. Quarter two was a plus of 7.6%. Quarter three was positive, right? That third quarter of our year, mm-hmm, right? July, August, September was technically positive, but it was barely positive at a 0.16. And the fourth quarter was huge, 10.1 in a quarter, right? The last 3 months. And you would have thought at that point, oh my goodness, 2022 is going to be great. Well, we went from a plus 10 to over a minus 5 in quarter one.
Okay.
Which again, leading indicator, markets pulled back 5% after it was up 10 the previous quarter. We could be looking at something rough. Yeah, quarter two was rough in 2022. We were down over 16.5% at that point. We all think of 2022 as a terrible year. But if you look at the fourth quarter of 2022, guess what was on sale?
Everything.
Everything. So quarter four was up over 6%. So those last 3 months of 22, way up. Then you saw January of this year was up another 6%. Oh my goodness. Yes, February is a little down. As we sit here toward the end of March, we're a little bit up. Overall, the last 6 months, markets are up over 10%.
So it's almost like you take that kind of, you know, mathematical average. You take your up and your down, you add it all together, divide it by that, and it still comes out with that baseline of not as bad as everyone thinks.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why the long-term view is absolutely the most important view that we can take.
Absolutely. Oh, as we are approaching the end of this, just got to ask, did I pass the class?
I'm going to give you an A today.
All right.
I'm
going
to give you an A today, Andrew. You've got that first grade looking pretty good here in Finance 101.
Perfect. Long way to go.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, folks, that is it for this edition of Money Matters. If you've got questions about anything that you heard on today's show, feel free to give me a call at 719-500-8700. We'll be back again next week talking about your money, as always, because your money matters. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.